This is Ken Paulson for Americana Music News, and we are honored, genuinely honored today, to have Jorma Kaukonen here. He's got a book, he's got a life story, and it's about time, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess. I guess I'm pulling into the sort of the memoir part of my life. Yeah.
Well, it's good to have a say on what your life is really all about.
That's true.
I was asking earlier what the length of the book was, and how many pages is the book?
It looks like, in the rough galleys, 420, I think.
See, that's hefty for a book, but doesn't surprise me, because with Hot Tuna, you would play for 24 minutes a song. So
yeah, right. We don't play. You know, my ex-wife, may she rest in peace, used to always theorize that we play such long sets because I was afraid to come off stage and face her. We don't play that long anymore. But yeah, I know what you mean. Absolutely.
So your expression has always been elongated in a very positive way.
Yeah, so, I hope so. Yeah.
Anyway, the new book is called "Been So Long: My Life and Music at St. Martin's Press," I believe.
That is correct.
And for those of you who are listening to this and may not have a full appreciation of who Jorma is and was, this man is a pioneer of rock and roll in so many ways. A member of the Rock and Hall of Fame.
I am,
and good company there. He was there at the beginning of the San Francisco rock scene. He certainly was influential, forming the Jefferson Airplane in 1965. Is that right?
August 13th, 1965, the first date, yeah.
And with a young woman named Signe Anderson as the lead vocalist.
That's true. She was then, yeah.
Went on to create Hot Tuna, and with Jack Cassidy, has been a great and vibrant solo artist for many, many years. I will tell you, in 1974, I ran out to buy Qua. I loved the music, and I thought the album cover was so cool. So. Yeah.
My ex-wife, God bless her.
Hey, so it's good to have you here.
Well, thanks.
Let's do this chronologically, roughly chronologically.
Sure.
I know you grew up in the D.C. area.
Right.
Which turns out to be, I've lived there several times, a surprisingly rich area for folk music.
It is, and you know, we're having this conversation at the Folk Alliance, and in a way, I'm sort of coming full circle here, because I started out as, I guess, what you call a folkie, basically, and I realized that my experiences in rock and roll tainted me for a number of years, and I was probably shunned by some of the purists, but heck, it's all music, right?
Right.
But the D.C., you know, when I was in junior high school and high school, you know, people forget that D.C. is really a southern town, and it's incredibly rich, musically speaking. There's all kinds of stuff going on. When I was a kid, I was born in 1940, so, you know, when the rock and roll thing started to happen, radio stations weren't formatted back then, so you could hear the Louvin Brothers, you could hear Elvis, you could hear Carl Perkins, you could hear black rhythm and blues groups. I mean, that's just the way it was back then. And we didn't give it a second thought. That was our environment. So, when I started to play, when we looked at the music that was accessible to us as unschooled musicians at the time, a lot of stuff that fell to me was like Carter Family, you know, some of the easier flattened Scruggs stuff. I was a guitar player, so it was easy to play rhythm guitar. I didn't have to play that fast, and all that stuff, and that's the way it was. And we heard those songs on the radio. We weren't playing traditional songs. We were playing the songs we heard.
How did you develop your own finger-picking style?
I learned to fingerpick. I was 20 years old when I learned to fingerpick. I mean, to really fingerpick. And the guy that taught me, a guy named Ian Buchanan, get a chance to check out his widow has a website called Winding Boy Blues. It's got a lot of his stuff. And the guy was brilliant. He died very young. Anyway, he was a friend of Reverend Gary Davins. It's not a student. I was talking at an interview earlier. We could geek out about right-hand styles a lot. The Reverend only played with the first finger of his right hand and his thumb, and I played with three fingers. So even when I started to learn Reverend stuff, it didn't sound the same. Ian was really my inspiration for playing with three fingers. It just made more sense to me than getting that first finger to work so hard to play all those notes. So what was important to me in the beginning was not necessarily replicating the masters, although I was certainly influenced by them, but I just wanted to play the songs. And so I caught a lot of static later on, like when I was in the in the folk scene in 1960, 61 in New York City, a lot of the guys like Dave Van Ronk and some of those others, the other generation ahead of me, well, so-and-so didn't play it like that. And that's how it was. Well, the good news was it's worked out okay for me. And so, and it was strictly a function of my inability to really grasp some of the under-the-skin stuff that the guys did. And that was good enough for me then. Now, I do a lot of teaching today also, and I've done it long enough seriously so that I know I can show people exactly what I'm doing. But my thing to them is, listen, the overview is just to be able to play something rhythmically and keep the groove happening, you know. If it's important for you to actually learn something the way I'm doing, I'm happy to show you, but it may not be natural to do. And to me, it's more important to be yourself. So I sort of developed my style such as it is just because it's really all I could do.
Yeah, well, that makes perfect sense. Yeah. So you arrived in San Francisco 63 or so?
62. Actually, I told my friends I was in San Francisco. I was actually in Santa Clara going to school.
Close enough. And did you run into some of the people who would later become legendary
figures
there? Sure.
You know, this is one of these classic stories that you couldn't script. When I moved to went to Santa Clara in 62, I went to this very conservative Catholic school, the University of Santa Clara, and I'd already worked and lived in apartments. Now I'm back in the dorm with these people I consider to be unbelievable squares. They're probably all Supreme Court justices or something now. But anyway, so I was just wondering, what have I gotten myself into besides staying out of the draft for another year? And I'm walking on the campus, and there was a little mimeograph flyer. We can all remember mimeographs.
Yeah.
And it said, Hootenanny tonight at the Folk Theater on First Ave, First and Osri in San Jose. I got somebody to give me a ride. I didn't have a car. And that first night, I met Janis, a guy named Richmond Talbot. I didn't meet Jerry and the guy so later
Janis
on.
Janis Joplin.
Janis Joplin, correct. And Janis had not brought an accompanist with her, and I knew, if not the song she did, I knew the idiom really well. Wow. So we did a bunch of stuff. There's a lot of these tapes, strangely enough, you know, one of my friends actually taped that, and you can find it on YouTube.
Wow.
And as I was saying earlier today, I knew immediately when I heard her that I was in the presence of greatness.
Really?
You know, yeah. And then it was going on. None of us had cars back then, so traveling around, going to San Francisco was like a day trip, you know. Yeah. But it was a fascinating time, and a lot of the names we've all come to be familiar with were just neighborhood folkies back then.
Wow. Well, the Airplane, really kind of a folk group before you describe it a rock.
Oh, absolutely. Right. The first album, Takes Off with Signy, that's a folk rock album. No, right. Absolutely, yeah.
And did you have any sense, I mean, you know, now truly a legendary band, did you have any sense that this was going to be any more than just one more band for you?
Well, I'd never been in a band before, and Paul had Paul Cantor's, I knew him before the Airplane, and he's the one that got me in the band. And I really, it's funny to think about this today, I agonized over the purity of my intent by forsaking. I was going to go to Denmark and sing with Champion Jack Dupree or something. I don't know what I was going to do. I just graduated college. The thought of playing commercial pop music was just like, it was anathema. It was a black hole, you know. Which is funny to think about it, because who wants to play unpopular music anyway? But, you know, I got in the band. It turned out to be Seductive. So it was such a learning experience for me, because I'd never really played in a band before. I was not a lead guitar player. I was basically a fingerstyle player. But we rehearsed 9-10 hours a day. It's all we did. And they allowed me the latitude to become me. Yeah. So, no, once again, we just kind of, like Chris Smither says, I fell into it when I was a kid, and I never fell out of it.
Yeah. Well, and you ended up, because of your style, bringing a unique sound to the Airplane.
Sure, yeah.
And then you also had a propensity. I mean, you were yeah, genuinely a good musician,
yeah,
and you let them stretch in a way. So
right,
yeah, you had somebody to love, but you also had longer
right,
jams.
Exactly. Yeah, you somebody to love is a or White Rabbit is a highly architected song. Excuse me. Yeah, in that era, and the era of the first two records, we tended to be more song-oriented, but I was so fortunate to have a bass player like Jack in the band, and Spencer Dryden, the first drummer, who was incredibly inventive and just had golden ears. And so when my abilities began to approach my imagination, I had the right people to do it with.
Right. So fast forward to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame,
sure.
which you should be very proud of.
As I am.
At one point, though, I mean, when the airplane dissolved, it was 72 or so?
72, yeah.
You had to think that was a nice ride. We will never reunite. I will never,
right.
There will be, you know, no one will remember this band 25 years
That's
from,
funny,
from
yeah.
now. And when did it dawn on you that, no, this has staying power, and the rest of my life I'll be revered and respected because I was guitarist for the airplane?
We're probably having this conversation because of the airplane. It's so amazing to me that what we did, some of the others, you know, we were a little more a lot of the San Francisco spirit was in that sort of, like, you know, happening kind of place. But we were a little more cohesive than some, and we were consistent. We could replicate what we did on a regular basis. But to think that people take college courses today in psychedelic music is incredibly ironic to me.
Yeah. And yet when the band did break up, and everybody went sort of in their own way.
Right.
You weren't tempted to stay with a Starship kind of model?
Well, the reason the band broke up, I guess, is because Jack and I just walked away.
Right.
And had I to do it over again, I probably would have maybe had a farewell tour or something. But at the time, when I was done, and I just stopped showing up.
So Hot Tuna allowed you to do what that you weren't able to do with the airplane?
I think one of the things that happened with the airplane is it just wasn't starting to be as much fun anymore. And I'm not sure what Jack and I thought about with what Hot Tuna would or wouldn't be. We'd been using it sort of as just like an outlet even before it had a name, because the airplane went through this whole thing where they just weren't touring a lot, and I really enjoyed doing that. And so we sort of started to fill the void that was sort of de facto being made by the headspace the airplane was in at the time. And the mere fact, and I only say this half in jest, the mere fact that Hot Tuna, or Jack and myself, have never had a band meeting, and the airplane had them all the time, really, honestly, had a lot to do with the fact that we're still together and the airplane wasn't.
Right.
So I was never a candidate for the Starship because we were reading and the airplane broke up. And, of course, one of my running gags is I always quit the band before we make the big money because, of course, the Starship had all the hits and stuff.
Yeah.
But we're in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Amen. So the Hot Tuna, I mean, Hot Tuna went on for literally decades.
Oh, yeah, we started in, we're still, yeah. So, I mean, who could even conceive of this sort of thing? You know, Jack and I have been playing together since 1958 in one form or another. And the Hot Tuna thing, people occasionally ask, because, you know, we write new songs occasionally, but we're not, you know, constantly reinventing ourselves. And aside from people that come because we're part of the soundtrack of their life, I think one of the things that we bring to any performance that we give is that it's a really honest performance. That's who we are, you know. We're not that we don't phone our parts, and we're in there to play music. And I think audiences feel that, you know. I mean, obviously, I've seen people, what, you guys play too long, or you're just playing blues. Whatever. Yeah. Whatever. We're still here.
And your audience is cross-generational.
It is cross-generational, which is fascinating to me also because, yeah, I have a 12-year-old daughter, and, you know, we're using this line to death, but it just says that she goes, well, Dad, you know it's not my kind of music, but you're very good at it, you know? So the fact that a younger kid would actually be interested in not just the fact that I'm very good at it, but that what we're doing is a good thing.
So as you look back at a rich career, highly successful career, and you've got to consider what to put in the book, what jumped out at you that you said, I've got to tell this story?
Right. Well, I think when people talk to me about doing a book in 10 or 12, 15 years ago, at that time, and it wasn't St. Martin's Press, that's who I'm with now, what they were looking for, I believe, was me dishing dirt on people more famous than myself. That's the vibe that I got. Mm. And look, you know, all kinds of stuff happened back then that, as much as it hates us to admit it, we didn't invent sex, drugs, or rock and roll. So to me, those kind of stories are really the least, I mean, you know, it's just part of the deal, but those are the least interesting stories, really. for me, what was interesting in the tale, aside from including events that are important to people that might read it, like, you didn't talk about Woodstock enough. I get it. Okay. We'll talk about it a little more. How about another story about Jerry? All right, fine. You know, we were just the neighborhood guys, but okay. What really is important to me is just my personal development over the years. And I've tried not to immerse the reader in the canons of my mind syndrome, because that can be pretty tedious, you know. Yeah. But, you know, I've been blessed. I've had a really interesting life. There's a lot of fun stuff along the way, and hopefully I was able to bring that across.
Okay, I'll be that guy.
Okay.
The festivals.
Lay it on me.
You were at what has been romanticized as the best, Woodstock, or Monterey Pop, too. The best festivals.
Right.
You were both of those. You were at Altamont, which
correct.
Is legendarily the worst.
Yeah, the triumvirate of festivals, yeah.
Were they all just a blur to you?
Well, you know, it's interesting. In some respects, Woodstock, we weren't physically there that long. We came in the day before. We were, you know, I love people go, well, it must have been great riding around in tour buses. Rock and roll bands didn't ride around in tour buses. Country stars did. We were in Ford LTD wagons. We drove into Woodstock. As everybody knows, we went on 18, 20 hours late, whatever it was. And then we drove to New York to do the Dick Cavett show. So seeing what was happening there was overwhelming on some levels, but the actual duration of the story was shorter. Now, Monterey, that was a whole different thing, because it was earlier. Grace was just in the band. It was early in our career. It was the first time that rock and roll had been dignified by like a real, because Monterey was a pop fest. I mean, it was a jazz festival scene before that. It was a very small festival. I don't know the figures, but I doubt if there's more than 15,000 people. They're hard to remember. It was just small. So you could walk around. You could see the acts. You know, it was a zero pressure. So I remember that as being a really great time. A lot of fellowship and hanging out. You know, got to see Hendrix for the first time. You know, all that kind of stuff, you know. Tell you what I do remember about Woodstock is Santana set. Unbelievable.
Really?
I mean, you all seen the movies and stuff, but I still remember that as one of the most impressive live shows that I'd ever seen.
Very cool. And you're not near the darkness of Altamont.
Well, we weren't there when that guy got killed. Marty did get punched out. If you see the movie, you will notice that Jack and I continued to play until we fell over the drums, and then we stopped playing. You know, some things were just not meant to be.
Yeah.
Altamont, I mean, we've all read a lot about it, and I was there. It was just, they flew us in on a helicopter, but we got home, and with, you know, Marty got punched out, the Angels, all the stuff happening. We got home because by that time, you know, this is one of these things in my business, you know, they treat you like a god when you're going to the show. The helicopter, the limousine, as soon as you've played, see ya. And this was one of those see ya moments. So my ex-wife and Spencer and I, we went to the parking lot. This is true. We found some drunk guy passed out on the deck of a Mustang. I woke him up and said, if you let me drive you in this car to San Francisco, we'll buy you a Mexican dinner. And he said yes. And that's how I got home.
So on your 105th birthday,
yes,
what will you look back and say, this is what I'm most proud of?
I would say, after my kids, I would say my ability to turn people on to the masters that I revere, and at the head of that list would be Reverend Gary Davis.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Altamont was rough. Woodstock was ragged.
Yep.
But now you're touring in a much more sedate era.
I am. We came here from Stoughton, Wisconsin, in our tour bus. This is funny, you know. You can't always afford to do the bus, but when you can't, I have a truck. I drive my truck sometimes, too. But I love when somebody else does the driving these days. On this bus, because this is a solo tour, there's me, my tour manager, and my guitar tech. And the bus company goes, you know, most of these buses have like 12 or 13 bucks. We don't have any more of the band buses. Will you take a Star Coach for the same price? And I went, it used to belong to Snoop Dogg. I said, absolutely. So I have a stateroom with a queen-size bed in the back. I mean, really, that's really the blues.
So that's a That's a trivia question for the future. What does Yorma and Snoop Dogg have in common?
That's right, the tour bus.
Well, you've got a lot to be proud of. And I mentioned touring because I understand in August you're going back out to promote the book and and to tour. Yeah. So
I tour all the time now. You know, that's I'm busier now than I've ever been in my life. What between the touring and the Fur Peace Ranch, our music school thing. And that's a good thing. You know, because and this is a quote that I use all the time, but it's so true. When people say, do you ever think about retiring? My answer is, why? So I can spend more time playing the guitar?
The great Jorma Kalkinen.
Well done.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And now here's a new feature on the Americana Music News podcast. It's called First Person and features an artist talking about a brand new release. In this case, Kyle Frederick, who has a new album called Already November. And the song is called Marshall.
This is Kyle Frederick here to talk about my new record, Already November, available now on iTunes, Amazon, and most leading digital retailers. I'm excited about this record because it represents a year-long opportunity to work with my friend and musical guru, Byron House, who recorded, produced, mixed, and played bass. We worked at Bethlehem Road, his home studio, throughout 2017, 100 miles at a time, and on evenings when he wasn't touring the globe. It was also an opportunity to work again with very talented friends like Heidi Gluck, Jonell Mosser, Chris Carmichael, my better half Claire Davidson, and my old Alaskans bandmate Eric Horton, who keeps the Louisville music scene warm with his electric guitar and helps to run the Guitar Emporium. Byron's oldest son, Truman, played drums and percussion on several tracks. It is easy to hear that he is most definitely following in his father's footsteps. My friend and biographer, Bill Owens, was right on, I think, when he said these songs are intense explorations of love and loss, the search for meaning and redemption, the passage of time, and the legacies we leave behind. As a recovering rocker, this musical style was completely new for me. But as a Kentucky native, I have to assume that it was inevitably going to find a way to escape at some point. The song I have submitted to you is a whimsical fictional tale called Marshall about a murderous Texan bent on following his ex to California's central coast, where she thought she had found refuge from his madness. Alas, neither she nor her new lover and winemaker had not.
Marshall came from Dallas, moved to San Ynez out of spite and full of malice. He found his Sally in the vines. He had sworn to protect her. He was lying. He was lying. Marshall grew up in Texas. Before relentless winds of grief, oh God, protect us from ourselves and the fools we try to love. It was too late for Marshall, push came to shove. He headed west to California. There Sally thought she had eluded Marshall's scorn, yeah. She was mistaken, as was the vintner who had become Sally's love over winter. To come carry Chocolate Mountain, Marshall notched another mile, yet no one counted. As the dew slept under Sally, Marshall in that morning crept across the valley, pulled back the curtain, and he was certain that his journey and his fate were not in vain. When his revolver, it finally found her, so was the winemaker's blood forced to surrender. So was the winemaker's blood forced to surrender. It was 78, maybe 79. He tries hard to forget as he digs into hard time. Marshall hailed from Dallas, filled with bitter fire and lies and clutched and callous.
Almost everything on the record was written as I commuted from my home in Mount Juliet, Tennessee to Nashville, so much so that the working title of the album was The Commuter's Songbook until I wrote what would be the last song written for the project, as well as the title song and the first song we recorded. I dedicated all of these recordings to my friend R.J. Harper. Already November was written just after I had learned he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. He lived for 13 months. Claire and I attended his memorial in California, where T-Bone Burnett, George Strait, and others paid tribute. The album seems to be striking a chord, and we're very thrilled about that. I hope it offers something that everyone can relate to and enjoy. Learn more at KyleFrederickMusic.com. Thank you, Ken.
That was Nashville artist Kyle Frederick with a song from his brand new album, Already November, called Marshall, produced by Byron House. That's it for this edition of the Americana Music News Podcast. Please remember to subscribe. You will find us on Stitcher, on iTunes, and on Google Play Music, as well as other respected podcast platforms. Also, we've got a website, sun209.com, which is catalog number, by the way, of the first Elvis single. And please join our other 23,000 followers on Twitter. Thanks for listening.